That's the Kiki music. That means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we'll take a look at the return of Mad Men with its cigarettes and booze and great clothes and stories, too. We'll also examine the unreliable narrator, if you choose to believe us. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, Trey Graham has the week off, and with us, to our constant excitement, is our pal Barry Hardiman. Barry Hardiman,
Hi.
What do you do at NPR?
I'm an editor at Weekend Edition.
And you have already moved to our new HQ.
I have, although I have not actually been at HQ. I've not ruined headquarters yet, is what I'm trying to tell you yet. I have, you know, it's
But you've
it's
abandoned
still clean.
Your old office.
I have abandoned
all,
it.
As we will all be doing soon.
It's true. Yeah.
Sunrise, well, done that. Sunset.
We're always very excited to see Barry, as all of you know, and as all of you are always very excited to see Barry.
So mutual.
So,
sure.
So last night, as we tape on Monday, last night was the 2-hour kickoff of the 6th season of Mad Men on AMC. I watched it. I have already been heard on it on the blog today, so I will not start. Barry, do you want to start?
I will start.
What did you think of the 2-hour premiere of Mad Men?
Well, I'll tell you, it felt like 2 hours. I really love Mad Men. I mean, for me, I think the 4th season is really a truly perfect piece of television. And, you know, I love all the stuff that everybody loves about it.
Those being
the cigarettes and the drinking and the hair.
I love
and the,
cigarettes.
But I actually do love cigarettes. That's an actual thing. It is like smoking. So I love all that stuff. I will say, it's feeling, and I felt this way last season too, it's feeling a little more heavy-handed, you know, with than, for instance, that perfect 4th season felt to me. I felt a little less connected to just what was happening to the characters as much as what was happening to the characters, because Matt Weiner said it was happening like this, and it's all about death, you know?
Death symbolism was...
My God, I was sort of like, I mean, it really made you long for... You know, the sort of at least the Downton Abbey where, like, someone gets, it's a total shocker.
Yeah.
You know, so this was a little bit, I felt, I mean, the writing is wonderful. There's slight lines here and there that are just perfect. The acting is great. But I also, and I think, Linda, you and I have talked about this, I felt sort of betrayed by last season because of the Joan storyline a little bit.
Yeah, I was not a fan of the Joan storyline, and many people were, but I was not.
Yeah, well, it just didn't seem like her to me. Yeah. So talk about unreliable narrator. I feel like we had an unreliable narrator for her.
Yeah.
So that has been. But I'm loving Peggy leaning in. That is a woman, I'm telling you. Peggy is killing it. And yeah, I wish my hair were bigger.
Yeah.
Anyone?
Love Peggy.
I'm down with that.
How about you, Glenn?
Yes, funny.
It's a hair joke.
It's a hair joke. You know, I watch this show with... This show casts a spell. This show fills me with this sort of existential dread. It's like watching a horror movie, but you're just waiting for a new bout of anomie or a new somebody to be clinically depressed around the corner. Like, don't... don't take that drink. You'll vomit.
Don't sip that drink portentously.
Exactly.
There's ennui at the bottom.
Exactly. And sometimes it's actually like there are certain buildings that Betty should just not go into, that Betty goes into.
Right.
But mostly it just cast this spell, but the thing about it is that I'm noticing more and more, kind of touches on what you were saying, that spell breaks as soon as the credits come up, because it has the illusion of opacity, right? It has this illusion that, oh, there's all this stuff. It rewards attentive, active watching, as you said this morning in your piece. But then once the spell breaks, you're like, so he's reading the Inferno while he's in paradise. It's like, it's just a little... too on the nose.
Yeah.
However, there are moments like the phone call that Peggy had with the pastor. That is a perfect little comic scene. It's basically a Bob Newhart routine, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And
genius.
It's just small and perfect, but boy, this feeling of wanting the creators to know what they're doing and I don't, which is a thing that I really enjoy, I'm starting to feel like the creators know a little too much what they're doing, and they're playing their hand a little heavily.
Like they're telling you what's happening a little bit more, like subtext is text. I come at this show, confession, I had never seen this show until last night.
I am even fascinated to hear this reaction.
Even Thompson,
real.
Pop
pop culture expert.
Yeah, exactly. Stephen Thompson, pop culture expert. Yes, I had never seen
But the show has an audience
of
like this table. So.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
And except for Stephen.
Well, yeah, exactly. Three quarters of this table. So on one hand, A, I'm a little embarrassed to admit that because it is, you know, a gigantic pop culture blind spot of mine. And of course, coming into the show in its sixth season with all these characters and their subplots and their past and their, you know, and everything, obviously, I come into it a little bit like, durr.
You would never guess from looking at it which of those people have had sex before.
I'm assuming most of them have had sex. Oh, you mean with each other.
Yes, exactly.
I was certainly drawn to some characters more than others, understood what was happening with more people than with others. I sort of come at it, obviously, with way more questions than answers. Do any of you feel like, as this show is drifting into the late 60s, that these characters are sort of brushing up against the real world more than they have in previous seasons? Because it felt a little like these characters aren't quite connected to the era they're in.
So you mean like the real world of civil rights?
Of civil rights movement and
brushing is a barely. I mean, they are barely there.
There are certain things that were part of real life that the show has taken a huge interest in. The show has taken a huge interest in the roles of women. Mm-hmm. It has taken a huge interest in, you know, Peggy, who they were showing as this really tough advertising person, started off as a secretary.
Right.
And started off as a very timid secretary. Mm-hmm. And over time, you know, developed.
Emboldened.
Absolutely. So it's sort of the story of gender roles they've taken a lot of interest in. The story of the civil rights movement and other things they've taken much, much less interest in. What they have done a lot of is they've taken individual moments like the Kennedy assassination or certain other ones and built something around that. The Cuban Missile Crisis, they built a big episode around kind of the tension around the Cuban Missile Crisis. I think the show has been more interested in incorporating external events as events than necessarily spending a lot of time on current events in the news, in and out, with longer arc stories like the civil rights movement. There's been a little more room for headlines, stuff like that. So I think that is true. But I also think the other thing that's happening is as the show gets into the late 60s, the world feels a little dirtier because the very early 60s when the show started had such a clean, crisp aesthetic. Mm-hmm. And that was really the show's aesthetic. And so it was this very rich but also spare, kind of emotionally closed environment where everything was very sublimated, I guess I would say. Mm-hmm. Whereas as they move into the late 60s, one of the challenges for the show is that not only does the visual world become more chaotic and more unpredictable as far as the women don't all wear the same kinds of dresses.
Right.
As much as they did in the late 50s and early 60s, there were sort of certain styles that were pretty universal, more universal. Whereas once you get into the late 60s, you have somebody who dresses like Don's wife versus somebody who dresses like Peggy versus somebody who dresses like Betty. So I think that while the visual world is getting more complicated, the cultural world is also getting more complicated. So you have blurring of lines and roles and things like that, whereas the show really capitalized in the first season, I would say, on people straining against very neat boundaries.
Okay. Right. Do you find that there are more consequences to the way they've lived in earlier seasons? Are we getting to sort of what happens to these people because of things they've done before?
Well, that is the story of Don Draper.
Right. And that's the thing. I'm watching Don Draper, and obviously, because I know it's, having never seen the show, obviously I know who Don Draper is.
Yeah.
So I'm watching him kind of extra closely.
Yeah, right, right.
And, you know, there's a certain amount of, like, I'm sleeping with beautiful women and I'm very sad.
Well, and I think
I'm afraid of death.
It used to be, I think the shift in his character in particular over time has been, he used to have a sort of attitude of like, over here I'm sleeping with beautiful women and I have this glamorous life. And then he had a very, very secretive life of misery.
Right.
And the life of misery has kind of opened up enough now that it is kind of beginning to control his presentation of himself. And I think that's part of what happened in the pitch meeting where he had the idea for this ad, which he did not realize would look to other people and looked to me.
Entirely morbid.
Like an ad that suggested a guy who had committed suicide by walking into the ocean.
Right.
He didn't understand that his morbidity was showing.
Right. As I say, I am watching this show, and I'm just absorbing as much as I can, and I'm looking for clues. It's like I'm the world's worst grad student, and this is my thesis, right? And I'm just going to create a paper that has a pun in the title, and then I'll turn it into somebody. But what I want, I keep trying to pull from it a simple narrative. I want the narrative of Peggy is waxing, and Don is waning. And so that's what I'm finding all this evidence for it. And then I see this Vulture interview with Matthew Weiner, what he thinks of the sixth season. And I knew I should not have clicked on that.
I clicked on that.
Dude, what you think the show is about is not what the show is about.
Yeah.
Like, I want to talk about what you made, not what you think you made.
Yeah.
And in his mind, a little bit of a spoiler here, that pitch meeting is not about Don losing his mojo. It's about him not being quite in touch with his gifts, which is a slightly different, which is, it's not quite. So, yeah, I keep wanting the show to take me on a ride, but there's a willful obtuseness to it that's pushing me away.
I have to say, what you're talking about, Glenn, and what Linda, you mentioned with the earlier seasons and the straining against, you know, this sort of 60s veneer, you know, like all that great furniture and everybody sort of. I prefer the show at the office, and I think it's because it retains that quality there, even in these later seasons.
Right.
Yeah. He does not have that quality in people's homes. So the minute we got Betty and St. Mark's Place, it's not the show. And I think that's a little bit what you're talking about, too. I think Weiner has kind of gone beyond what this original sort of seed was. I mean, I want a sort of a simpler narrative. And that's why whenever the show is at the office, it is at its simplest, because people have to behave a certain way there. And you are just seeing their lives sort of seething underneath the surface. And so you see, you know, in that pitch meeting, you see Don losing his ability to see what's in front of him. Which, when you see him do that at the party, it's kind of like, or throwing up at the, sorry, this is spoiler, there's vomit. You know, at the party, there's, it's so obvious in this way that it doesn't retain the thing that I really love about Mad Men, which is this strain.
Right.
I agree. It's the tension between the constricted environment and the people's behaviors and wants and desires.
Now, you guys have watched the first five seasons of this. How often on this show does the sort of bubbling under the surface, there is tension, and there's a. How often is there a crack up?
Certainly, it's tougher to view the show episode by episode than it is season by season, because there's a lot of things that call back to each other. And in this episode, Stephen, there's a lot of references, visual references to to earlier scenes. So it does feel disingenuous to kind of go thumbs up, thumbs down with each episode, because so much
you don't know where it's leading.
Because, for example, there was a character, Lane, last season, and a lot of stuff happened in the premiere that kind of set up his eventual fate. You don't really see that happening until you can kind of look back at it. But yeah, I think there is a lot in here, and right now all I'm getting is, okay, so everybody's mentioning temperature. Why are they all mentioning temperature? Her coffee's gone cold. This hippie likes to be hot more than he likes to be cold. Don asks, what was death like? Was it a really hot temperature? Like, there's stuff there. I can't put it together yet, but it's being thrown out there as so much chaff, and I have to kind of eventually piece through it.
Yeah, one of the things that Mad Men does for me is it convinces me over and over again to free myself from feeling obligated to interpret a work the way that the person who created it necessarily does.
Totally.
There are times when creators are not the best interpreters of their own work, because it's not a puzzle.
Right.
You're not trying to say, what is he trying to say?
No. Mm-hmm.
There are times when, and you've got to remember, in addition to Weiner, you also have the actor contributing. You have other writers contributing, not perhaps as much as they do on other shows, but you have other people involved in writing. You have Janie Bryant doing the costuming, who is saying something about these people with every one of these choices. So you have lots and lots of people's creative energy. So Mad Men is a show that reminds me over and over again that you may feel like the creator didn't completely understand what wound up coming across in a scene or an episode or a story. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you're wrong, because he says, that's not what I was trying to say. It's a matter of what wound up coming out. Now, for me, my initial concern about this episode was that it started off with a long bunch of Don and Megan stuff. The way that other people felt, to make a cross show reference, the way that other people felt about Patrick Wilson on Girls, which was fantasy figure just there for you to sort of play around with the idea of this guy, is how I feel about Megan. I don't feel they've ever developed that character into a person I feel is a whole person. I think she is object only, not in the sex object sense, but in the acted upon sense. I don't feel like there are ever stories about Megan. There are only stories in which Megan is one of the moving parts. So I never care about her. and I always want them to get off of her because I don't, it's not a knock on the actress, although I don't love the actress. It's a knock on the fact that I simply, the way that you're talking about, it's not what he thinks it's about. I'm just not as interested in her and in Don's relationship with her as I think the people making the show are.
Yeah, and in that Vulture interview, he talks about how Don's relationship with Megan is different than Betty because she's a whole person. She's her own, you know, individual. And it's like, you don't...
I don't feel like she is. I feel like she's always been a child.
She's a projection of Don entirely. She's just a thing he is projecting his storyline on.
There's nothing wrong with that in the sense
but I just don't want to spend as much time in that world.
Exactly.
Except with her outfits.
And I agree. And I... Oh, yeah. I still do love to watch the... I still do love to watch the way that they manipulate environments and clothes and things like that.
Oh, it's gorgeous. Yeah.
There's a lot of incredibly great
and it's
stuff
shot very beautiful. I sort of forgot until last night how it's beautiful to look at in terms of blocking and scene shot and all of that stuff.
That was definitely one of my first, I mean, coming at it completely as an outsider, it's an incredibly, incredibly visually appealing show.
Yeah. Yeah,
and not just because of the beauty of the various actors, but in terms of
color. Doesn't hurt.
It doesn't hurt. Mm-hmm. In terms of color scheme. Mm-hmm. And costuming. Yeah, I mean, obviously, everything everything people have said about that is true.
But I do want to impress upon you, Stephen, that monologue that John Slattery gave about doors and, these doors open and you cross bridges, that hasn't happened before, where we've gotten that level of, I'm going to tell you what this episode's about during the episode.
Right. That disappointed
me. Why did some editor not look at that and say, oh, whoops, we've telegraphed it all?
Because he's great in it, is why.
Well,
he's
good. Really charismatic.
And so is the writing. It's a good idea. It's a great exegesis of the episode. If you assume that you want your episode to include someone sitting in therapy expounding upon all of the themes of your episode. But to me, somebody sitting in therapy is like somebody going through a photo album in a TV show. Which is like, as soon as I see it, I think,
or almost like voiceover narration.
You couldn't think of any other way to, you know, or the old comedies where some psychological researcher or IRS agent or something would come to the house and ask a lot of questions so they could have a flashback episode. It's like that when you have somebody sitting in therapy. Like, well, let me tell you how I feel about all this and what I've been thinking. Like,
Especially when that character is so internal. I mean,
there's
so clearly internal.
Interesting people, and the writing is so good that I felt like they could have just done that in story instead of explaining it to me quite so much. And I do want to call out one other thing that I absolutely loved, which was Peggy's phone call with Stan.
Oh, the phone call with Stan was amazing.
They are such pals. Mm-hmm. And this show, one of the difficulties of the show is because of the workplace constraints and stuff like that, it hasn't always been easy to feel like people have genuine, real friendships, especially her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Peggy has this incredibly special and important relationship with Don, which, of course, we didn't see at all last night.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been tough for her to have other relationships. It's tough for her to have relationships with men because of her position vis-a-vis them. It's difficult for her to have friendships with other women. She's certainly had moments. There were moments between her and Joan that are glorious.
Yeah.
But this was really one of the most kind of relaxed human conversations I think they've ever written on that show, and I just loved it.
I actually would say one of the things that was great about last night, all of Peggy's scenes were so real, so relaxed.
Right.
That bit of comedy with the pastor. But she seemed like a real person operating in a world
wonderful.
Sometimes Mad Men can get in that like sort of ice age of like, here, I've ordered a Don Draper and put him in this office, you know, kind of thing. But and she killed it.
She's wonderful. Yep. Well, we would love it if you came to find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or at the blog at npr.org/PCHH and told us what you think about Mad Men.
I'll be there answering questions about the show.
So before we move on to our other topic, we did have one thing that we wanted to touch on very briefly, although by the time you hear this episode, you will have heard a lot of people talk about it already. We did want to pause as a pop culture podcast and acknowledge the passing a few days ago now of Roger Ebert, one of our pop culture heroes who we have talked about on this show many times for his excellent and wonderful work. And I have sort of been heard at great length about this now, and we've all sort of had the opportunity to read lots and lots of great pieces. I encourage you to explore a bunch of them. If you name a critic that you like in TV or movies, they probably wrote something in the last few days about him and how he affected them and affected their work. So I would encourage you to look that up.
Yeah, just about everything that has been said. I mean, I would echo a lot of what has been said in the last few days. You know, first of all, the number of us at this table who probably wouldn't be doing this if it weren't for Roger Ebert. Even though I've never met him, he's had an incredibly significant impact on my life. And the other thing that I would say is how rare it is that people get to become more vital as they go along.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the fact that, you know, after losing his ability to speak, he somehow became more important and more trusted and more interesting.
Yeah.
And like, right up to the absolute very end,
right,
was just an incredibly important voice. It's, it's really sad.
He wrote a cookbook after he couldn't eat anymore.
Yeah.
That's the raddest thing in the world.
It's incredible.
There is no better way in the world to prove that you do not live in your own head.
Yeah.
You know, it's wonderful in that way.
There's something wonderful when someone like of his stature with so many admirers dies, that you get to then read the writing of so many people who learned from him. So reading all of those pieces was wonderful. But I have to say, the thing that I loved the most is the sort of final essays when he was really contemplating death. This is going to sound weird, especially after we just talked about Mad Men, which was an entirely morbid episode. No one made death seem like a gift more than Ebert. And I mean that in the best way. I mean, he made it seem like, in this truly, really original way, that his cancer was a vehicle to something really fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And because we're all sitting around being humans, like working, you know, getting to room temperature, you know, I think the ability to sort of ameliorate that particular part of the human condition for just little old me sitting in my kitchen is an extraordinary act of empathy. I mean, even without the criticism, I mean, Dayenu.
Right.
You know,
of course.
We're fine.
Of course.
With just the writing about his journey into, you know, the great unknown. Just amazing.
Yeah. Real quick, it's been stated, but I think it can't be overstated, that At the Movies, as a cultural artifact, changed the landscape. Mm-hmm. It had two people talking about film in a way that you never saw two people talking about film outside of a college course, perhaps. Mm-hmm. My dad started off tuning into that show to fume at it. Your job is to watch movies? This is just your opinions. And over the course of that show being a part of his week, every week, for years, it became appointment television for him. The idea of a movie critic changed from this guy who writes in the paper to something that he could engage with in a way that
conversation,
the point. So it was huge, and its influence is still being felt.
I think there are a million lessons, and you know, one of the last things that I had been thinking about after his final essay and prior to his death was that it's just remarkable how much, among a million other things, as we've been talking about, you know, who was better at sort of making the flip to new media, quote unquote,
right,
despite having been both a newspaper guy and a TV guy.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, was like, now I'm going to be a Twitter guy. Now I'm going to be a blog guy. Yeah. I love the internet. Like, let's argue about video games. Like, just was interested in everything, intellectually curious. Just could not be more grateful. Took that one very, very hard, but could not be more grateful for everything that he did and all the ways that we've talked about criticism, you know, meaning of life. Mm-hmm. Like, wonderful.
And the romance at the core of his life.
Oh, my. If you've never read the stuff he wrote about his wife, I'm just begging you. They're so beautiful. You just gotta. All right. So our other topic this week, we're going to talk about the unreliable narrator. Now, if you don't know what we mean by the unreliable narrator in fiction, well, Barry, you're a book person.
I'm not nearly as much of a book person as Glenn Weldon.
That's hardly true.
I don't know that I can teach this course.
I turn to you, Barry.
I might be an unreliable narrator.
What is your impression of the idea of the unreliable narrator?
Well, I think it's usually a first-person telling of, you know, somebody who is presenting the world as they see it. Mm-hmm. And as the narrative goes on, you realize that the world as they see it is maybe not exactly that. So I think the most famous... Help me here. I think the most famous example is probably Lolita.
Sure.
Where you have Humbert and Humina Humina. Sorry. I can't stop myself from doing that.
But there's a lot of different kinds, and we're not going to get into taxonomy. But, I mean, there are the classic one is the – well, not the classic one, but a big one is the madman. You know, like Poe played a lot with this.
Right.
Where, true, very, very nervous, I have been an M, but why will you say I am mad? Well – I kind of know where you're coming from, guy. It's the first sentence of the story.
You have a Poe voice.
That's amazing.
That was basically a Kermit voice. It was basically an insane Kermit voice. But American Psycho, see, a lot of them are, the madman is not telling you the whole story.
Right.
Or the liar is not telling you the story. Mm-hmm. But my favorite is the kind where it's not about dissembling. It's not about lying. It's about this person has a force of will that asserts one view of reality. And exactly as you said, Barry, gradually, and that's the key, gradually over the course of the story, you see these other characters, other events kind of brushing up against and bouncing off and asserting a slightly different version of reality, in which case you start to pay attention to what's going on around the edges. Alan Bennett has a series of monologues called Talking Heads, which we've talked about on the show before, in which exactly that happens. The characters, many of them, address the audience directly to tell the story about their lives, and gradually over the course of the short monologue, you start to fill in everything around them. The classic example is in Remains of the Day, the butler Stevens finds out that his father has died, and then pages later, a character comes up to him and informs him and the readers that he's crying. He didn't realize he was crying. The reader didn't realize he was crying because he's so cut off from his emotions.
Right.
The reason I wanted to bring this up is because I just read a novel. I just reviewed it for NPR. I'm not going to say which one it is because if I tell you which one it is, the fact that it's an unreliable narrator is kind of one of those things you don't really know at the beginning.
This is one of the really tricky things about this conversation
is
how often the unreliability of the narrator is the whole twist and the whole thing you don't want to give away. So there are a bunch of movies I don't even want to mention.
Yeah, I can see what you're saying. I'm thinking of the same movies you are.
Yeah.
But there's something, it's a wonderful novel, and I won't mention it here, but maybe at the end under What's Making Me Happy, I'll mention the name of the novel so people will know how much I loved this novel and I'll recommend that novel. But what was amazing about it was it's a slim little book, but it feels like an omniscient narrator. It feels like he's just presenting the world as it is. And then gradually, his crazy prejudices, he starts to mention them passingly. And you start to, what? Well, I don't feel that way. That's not the way the world is. And it happens so gradually, and it keeps you so close to his head that it's a spell, basically, that this book casts. And it's just amazing.
The example I wanted to bring up is not only the original work, but everything that has been endlessly spun off and inspired from it, which is Rashomon.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
And which is
the unreliable narrator is everyone!
Everybody! and I love...
Which in many ways is the most true to life.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I... exactly what I was going to say, which is just... No, it's great. That is the closest thing I think you get to sort of truth in narration.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, the concept of Rashomon, it's a classic Kurosawa film, is you have an incident and then multiple retellings of that incident from other people's perspective. And you see this in sitcoms almost as, at least for a while, you would see it in sitcoms almost as often as you would see a Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
and so the wonderful kind of, you take the story and then you view it through all these different perspectives that sort of illuminate what has happened in different ways until you either don't know what happened or you get a complete picture from these different perspectives.
Yeah.
And I love the way it's just sort of tied into the very notion of empathy.
Right.
Yeah.
That your perspective on something is going to be different from other people's perspective. And my parents, growing up, as I've mentioned on this show, my parents were always kind of showing me what they felt were important pieces of popular culture.
And Midnight Cowboy.
And my parents were obsessed with Rashomon. Mm. And would always sort of say, as a shortcut, they would mark up the sides of their videotapes with the plot points or whatever. And it would just say in parentheses, Rashomon in all caps.
Mm-hmm.
as one of their favorite methods of storytelling.
Yeah. It was interesting because when I started thinking about this, I realized that you get the Rashomon kind where what's being emphasized is the fact that everything looks different from different people's perspectives. Then you get, as Glenn was mentioning, the madman version where you start to gradually realize that somebody's not telling you the whole story. But you can see that in something as profound as Kurosawa, or literally the first thing that popped into my mind when we thought of this topic, and I apologize for this, was the Bare Naked Ladies song, The Old Apartment.
Broke into the old apartment.
Starts out as a guy talking about breaking in, literally, to the apartment where he used to live with his girlfriend. And at first, it's kind of like this story, and you're listening to the guy talk about, like, describing the place and everything. And then he starts to talk about the holes that he punched.
Why did you paint the walls? Why did you clean the floor? Why did you plaster? The hole I punched in the door.
And you start to realize that this is somebody who has broken up with his girlfriend because he was violent and terrifying.
Right.
And most likely she fled, and that's why they don't live there anymore. But the way he's telling the story, it goes to this place of, ultimately, why did I have to break in? I only came here to talk. So it's scary. It gets very menacing. And for them, it is very menacing.
They're so boppy.
And you realize that you could listen to this song many, many times before you started to really listen to it. And then you realize, oh, that's a scary dude.
Yeah. Right.
That's like a scary, menacing dude. And you can, it can happen in a, you know, profound piece of storytelling, or it can happen in something as light as a pop song.
Well, I was hoping you guys would find some music examples, because it seems to me that when it happens in music, it's one of those times when the storyteller is not the storyteller, but a character.
Right. You know,
he's creating a character. And it's a thing that doesn't happen as often.
That's the issue, trying to find examples in music, because I was thinking like Slim Shady.
Sure.
You know, I was thinking about various sort of like They Might Be Giants songs that are told. But you do often run into exactly what you said, Glenn, which is it can be an unreliable narrator. There are certainly elements of the unreliable narrator, but a lot of what you're getting is a songwriter who is writing from the perspective of other characters.
Right.
And so in the space of a pop song, you don't necessarily... I mean, the Bare Naked Ladies song is a good example of a band sort of finding a way to work that twist into, you know, 3.5 minutes. But it's very tricky to do within a song, within one song.
So can I ask a question? Do you think that, because I was thinking about this on my way here, and I was thinking all of the examples that I can think of, be they in song or in movies or in... You tend to have, I mean, it tends to be the sort of American Psycho, you know, turn of the screw. It tends to be the ghost story, the mystery, the angry boyfriend. There's an element of... not horror, maybe, but mystery, a certain kind of... The twist is usually with the unreliable narrator, something truly unsavory.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I was thinking, because I loved Martin Amis when I was in my 20s, and then promptly did not love him more when I became a feminist. But I was thinking my favorite kinds of unreliable narrators, like Stephen, I will say, are when you have the two-perspective thing, or more than one multiple-perspective thing, like Gone Girl is another thing. Because then it doesn't sort of run down this path toward this inevitable, and I'm actually a, you know, I'm actually a psycho killer kind of thing.
Right.
I realized in unreliable narration, I really prefer the softer tale, because otherwise... You and now I'm really dying to read whatever book you just read.
Okay.
I really prefer, because we all are unreliable narrators, I prefer that softer touch.
Sure. But, I mean, Huckleberry Finn is sort of an unreliable
narrator.
Because he's thinking the best of others. He's imputing all these noble motives to people who are really not noble.
Yes. Yeah.
My favorite unreliable narrator is the one that combines that assertiveness we were talking about before, this is the way the world is, with... a complete lack of self-awareness.
Right. Yes,
so it has, it's not willful. It's not, as I say, dissembling or lying. It's basically this person. Because that, what does fiction do? It puts you in the head of somebody else. And what I like about this kind of fiction is that it puts you in the head of somebody else and it exaggerates your faults, where you think the world is this way, and you're willing to kind of assert it until the dam busts. And it's a way to teach a moral lesson without doing it in a very heavy-handed way.
Yeah, I agree.
Don Quixote also has some of that that same sort of thing going on. But I just, it's the ultimate postmodern thing where this thing we've trusted for centuries, the narrative voice, is now called into question.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a mid-century, you know, twist.
And one thing that I love about the movie Memento,
which is another example,
is when the narrator is in as much suspense as you are. Mm-hmm. That's neat and a tricky twist to pull off.
Well, and it's very tricky not to make it. For some reason, I find that in film in particular, if you find out too much information that seems to have been withheld, people feel that they've been cheated.
Mm-hmm. Like it's not a mystery so much.
They feel that they've been misled. Mm-hmm. So it's very tricky to withhold enough from the audience. There's something about the visual of cinema where people feel like what they should be seeing should be a fairly literal translation of the world.
Right.
And so they become more unhappy if they feel that there's been active withholding. Whereas they are more accepting of it, I think, when they are reading...
I think on the page,
when they're reading on the page. And to bring up a book that, shockingly enough, I don't think we've ever mentioned on this show, ever, Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah.
Oh, is an unreliable narrator, not because of necessarily flaws, mm-hmm. but just because of position in life. And right, you come right. to understand that his position and his youth make him very bad at explaining certain things and very insightful about others. Right. And I think that's the trick. You know, I have not read the entire book Room.
Oh, right. Oh,
but
right,
yeah. when I heard Emma Donoghue mm-hmm. read from that book, that was sort of the sense that I got, was that it was the same thing, that because you're talking about something narrated by a very young child, you get a very unreliable voice. But a good writer can use that to sort of point out that you may be very bad at explaining point A, mm-hmm. but your youth and your perspective may give you unique insight into point B, and that's the same way I think Holden Caulfield is.
Right. Mm-hmm.
How have we never talked about Catcher
that's
in the
so
Rye
weird.
Before?
You're right.
Yeah, I broke the seal.
Now we can have a whole Catcher in the Rye show.
That's right. Yeah. I broke the seal. It's mm-hmm. out there now. It's out there
now. Somebody has got the rights to a new YA novel on that. So,
well, I hope that that all of you will come and find us on Facebook, find us on the blog, talk to us about your favorite unreliable narrators. And we love talking about this kind of stuff, and we appreciate all of your input. And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
This is a kind of a time of year when, in my little music world, all of a sudden you're getting a bunch of big spring music releases mm-hmm. and a bunch of sort of favorite bands coming out of the woodwork. And on the site right now, we've got, you know, a new Iron and Wine, a new Flaming Lips, which is a little difficult. Mm-hmm. You know, a couple records coming up that I'm excited about. There's a new National album coming out in May, one of my favorite bands. That record is quite good. And on the site, the day we are taping this, got to post the first song from a new album. And I know Linda is my soul sister on this particular point.
As opposed to about everything else.
As opposed right. to many, many other things. The first new song in ages from a singer named Sean Nelson, who was the lead singer of Harvey Danger, which just happened to be one of the most underrated bands of the last 15 years. And, you know, Harvey Danger had this one gigantic hit in 1998 called Flagpole Sitta.
Make them seem like a novelty band, which
it really
they
does.
Are
yeah,
not.
Yeah, really, really not. It's also like anyone who's ever encountered Sean Nelson in life, to the least likely person ever to record a jock jam.
Yeah. That's true.
Like it's on these jock jams compilations, not a jock.
If you've listened, by the way, to the happy making playlists that I've posted on Spotify, one of them kicks off with the Harvey Danger song,
"Happiness Writes White."
Mm-hmm.
Such a great song. That whole album, Little by Little, mm-hmm. from 2005, is just perfect. Yeah. Anyway, Sean Nelson has a new album, finally, 8 years in the making, coming out June 4th, called Make Good Choices, which is a great title for an album. And you can watch the video for the title track and download the title track mm-hmm. On the NPR website. We will throw up a link to it, but I am just delighted to have Sean Nelson back.
I promise everything's all right. It's just I think of you sometimes. I like to stay up after midnight and listen for the chimes we used to hear, so loud and clear. But I haven't heard that song in years.
And also followed the link to the other song, The Show Must Not Go On, which I think after I was reminded of it today, I listened to about 15 times in a row.
Yeah, let's hear a little bit of The Show Must Not Go On, because that song is so awesome.
It's not hard to see.
Show Must Not Go On is the last Harvey Danger song, and as you can tell from the title, it is a perfectly
perfect. It's shocking.
It's a breakup song that doubles as a band breakup song, doubling as a mission statement on life. And God, he's such a great songwriter.
Mm-hmm. Barry Hardiman, what is making you happy this week?
It's a book. I'm not going to lie. I'm sorry. I wanted it to be something else. But this week, it's a book.
We love it when you talk about books. So
last week, Meg Wolitzer's new book, The Interestings, was released. I cannot say enough about this book. Now, I know that it is not everyone's favorite book. I do not know that it will be everybody's cup of tea. But I read it in one sitting, and then I went back and read it again. Mm-hmm. It is the story of six teenagers who go to an arts camp. And they are all very talented, then goes on to follow them for the next 40 years. This is her big epic book.
Oh, I'm going to have to read this.
Oh, my God. Linda, I can't wait to talk to you about this book.
All right.
But the themes are so wonderful because it's this arts camp, and there are some who are sort of mediocrely talented and some that are wildly talented. Mm-hmm. And everybody goes on to their various sort of lives, and some have great success and some don't. And the way she talks about talent and what a good life is and how much you have to express of your own talents in order to sort of fulfill those gifts or not is the smartest thing I've ever read. And also sort of the nature of envy between friends, because that's life, you know? We watch each other succeed and fail, and I just think it's a brilliant book. I can't say enough about it. And I also, one thing I want to note about it that I really just love is Meg Wolitzer, a year ago, wrote a wonderful essay in the New York Times on a subject near and dear to my heart, and I know Linda's heart too, about men and women in literary fiction and how...
Oh, yes,
I remember that.
It was a brilliant essay. And she mentioned, I believe her opener is about Jeffrey Eugenides' novel, The Marriage Plot. And she says, you know, if this had been written by a woman and had a wedding ring and been called The Marriage Plot, would we have called it The Great American Novel, or would we have called it Chick Lit?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I realized that to a certain extent she was working out the, now that her novel has come out, and this is unquestionably a novel about relationships, because relationships are life. That's
right.
Not just domestic drama. But it's kind of wonderful, too, because it's blurbed by Jeffrey Eugenides on the front cover, who loved it. And I think this is her freedom. This is no different than Franzen. This is the same thing.
Yeah.
So I encourage everybody to read it and talk to me about it, because there's nothing I like better.
Great.
Fantastic. Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
Okay, very quickly, the name of the book that I enjoyed so much with the unreliable narrator, I will now say, so skip ahead 10 seconds if you don't want to hear it. It is Equilateral by Ken Kalfas. It's a slim little book. You'll devour it in half an afternoon. It's great. But the thing that's making me happy this week is a video game called Dishonored. Now, it's been out a year, and I know the only video game everybody's talking about now is BioShock Infinite. I know. I'll get to that in a year. I'm still a year behind everybody else because I was writing a book.
Hey, man, I'm still playing Donkey Kong.
Right, okay.
Street Fighter.
I love this game, and I am so terrible at it. So very, very terrible. So the objective is it's basically a little like, Jess Gittner, you'd like it. It's a little like Assassin's Creed. You are an assassin. You're in this city, which is overrun by plague, by a rat plague, and you have to kind of complete your mission, which is sometimes assassinating people, being all stealthy and not stepping out of the shadows and doing it. And there's infinite variety of ways you can complete these missions, and you know, you're supposed to do it stealthy, because if you do it stealthy and don't kill too many people and aren't detected, the number of rats in the city don't go up, and the rats don't bite people and turn them into what?
zombies,
of course.
Yes.
Because it was made in 2012. Zombies. But if you play very sort of chaotically and start killing people a lot, then those corpses attract more rats, and there's more rats in the subsequent levels, and there's more zombies, and it has a much darker ending. And I start every level tippy-tippy-toeing around, being a little ninja guy, and I step out into the light once, and they all come running at me and say, I see you there! And then I just have to go to town. I have to kill them. I have to kill them brutally, because that's part of this game. But there's this wonderful thing where this tension of, like, tippy-tippy-toe, and then they come, and I go, here's your heart. I'm going to show it to you before you die. So what I've decided is, the reason I'm playing so poorly, and I'm playing this on easy, by the way. I have no shame. I'm not going to front. I'm trying to play this on easy, and I still suck. That I imagine, because you can't see yourself. You can never see yourself. It's done from your point of view. So I imagine that my character is actually like a Who's Harry Crumb era John Candy. Who just tries to tippy-tippy-toe around. And he's like in disguise, but you can see it's John Candy. And he's like there going, I am the knight. I strike from the shadows. You can't see me. And, of course, everybody can see him, and they just come running out. So that's how I've explained the reason I suck so much at this wonderful, wonderful game called Dishonored.
Wait, wonderful. Why is it called Dishonored? What does honor have to do with
because
rats?
Because you were the Empress's right-hand man,
there's
and you were
backstory.
Framed for her
yeah.
murder, and then you go to the jail, and you have to kind of tippy-toe out of the jail, or slaughter nice. Everybody, in my case, to get out of the jail. So
every game should have a John Candy yeah. setting.
I know, right?
Well, thank you for that, Glenn Weldon.
Sure.
Now, before we get to what's making me happy this week, we have a very, very special treat.
We do.
We really do. In the Pop Culture Happy Hour family, you know me and Stephen and Glenn and Trey. You know Jess and Mike. You know our favorite subs, Barry and Tanya and Matt Thompson and everybody else who's been on the show.
Bob
Chris
Mondello.
Klimek and Bob Mondello and Mark Hirsch and everybody who's been on.
My mother.
Stephen's mother. But there is a member of the Pop Culture Happy Hour family who you've heard mentioned.
Yep.
But you've never actually heard.
Just... tearing back the veil.
We're tearing back the veil. That is the airy giggle in the background of our near and dear pal, Pop Culture Happy Hour's number one fan, who's not Stephen's mother, Margaret H. Willison.
Yay!
Margaret Willison is here from Boston.
I don't know who Margaret Willison is.
Visiting us.
I only know of a Margaret H. Willison.
That's my mother.
Margaret... we're so happy to see you.
Hi, I'm obviously very happy to see all of you guys, too.
How are you?
A little overwhelmed.
All right, well, Margaret, I did tell you prior to you coming to visit us that I was going to make you tell us what's making you happy this week. So, Margaret H. Willison, what is making you happy this week?
Well, other than the violation of the Zaxxon rule, being here, I'm a very happy person, and I am taking... two things. I was planning on one, but you guys are talking about unreliable narrators, and I can't help but give a shout out to the book that's been emotionally devastating me for like 2.5-3 days. It's a young adult novel called Codename Verity.
Oh my god, I loved this book.
It's amazing.
I loved this book.
It ripped my heart out and put it through a blender and then poured acid on the remains.
Yes.
Basically, if you like World
War
II...
And then Glenn shot it with rats. Sorry.
Basically, I mean, if you have any interest in England or World War II, or like really, if you have a best friend...
Yes.
Just read it. You too. It's about a spy and a pilot during World War II. I don't even want to tell you more, but...
You can't.
It's yeah. just... astoundingly good and emotionally devastating. So that's making me happy, but really making me sad. But actually making
but
me
in
happy.
In a happy way.
Giddy, even, is the Lizzie Bennett Diaries. It's a YouTube series created by...
Yeah, we haven't talked about this. We should have.
It's excellent. You guys should watch it and then do an episode on it so that I can listen to it at home.
Yeah.
The Lizzie Bennett Diaries, it is a retelling of Pride and Prejudice through video diaries created by Lizzie Bennett. I put off watching it for like 9 months because I was like, this is going to be poppycock. This is going to be nonsense.
Is that the first use of poppycock ever on the show?
I totally just fell in love with you all over again. It's so great to have that be two ways.
I know.
So I thought it was going to be dreadful. And it takes a little bit of time to get used to the format. Just like when you're watching Doctor Who, you're like, wow, these special effects look like they were done with four-year-olds with markers. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. But as soon as you get into it, it's really great. It understands its source material certainly better than Bridget Jones's Diary, which I love. And one of the best things about it is it really makes the friendships between the sisters very central to the story and very central to Lizzie's emotional journey. And it actually has a spin-off series that centers on Lydia Bennett that I like more than anything else the series has done. It's just really thoughtful, really emotional, and manages to inject an astonishing amount of suspense into one of the most well-known stories of all time. So, Lizzie Bennett Diaries, check it out. You can fund its DVD production on Kickstarter, and you can fund the production of its new series on Sanditon, which is one of Jane Austen's unfinished novels, as well. And I hope you like it.
Did we mention that Margaret is a librarian?
Margaret is a librarian. Margaret is, as I said, our number one fan. Awesome. She's the head of the PCHH Librarian Corps.
Yep.
She's rapping hard.
Hilarious and lovely and has been a wonderful friend to us and to our show. Has been heading up the commenter army and the Facebook army and the good cheer army.
Spending too much time on social media.
And the be on your side when people are mean to you army. And it's just the best. And I'm incredibly grateful that we could bring her to you so that now you can experience her charm for yourself.
So that is
the first thing that is making me happy is being able to share the microphone with Margaret, which is just so awesome. Number two, NPR has a new blog called Code Switch.
Oh, it's so good.
Code Switch is our kind of race, ethnicity, culture project. They have put together a killer team for this project. They are a bunch of incredibly high-powered, really smart, great, awesome people. Some of my favorite people at NPR are on this team. The lead blogger is Jean Demby, who was a natural ally of mine from about 30 seconds into when we met.
It literally took 30 seconds.
It took 30 seconds for us to become allies. He is the only person besides Stephen who is allowed to call me Holmesy.
That's right. And he did ask.
He did. And he's a terrific writer. Again, Code Switch. He wrote today about the meaning of code switching and also about Mad Men.
Awesome.
Love it.
Best.
Number two, today the weather was unbelievably gorgeously beautiful, so I drove with the windows down and listened to Mass Romantic, which Stephen taught me as a springtime ritual, and which I still do.
By the New Pornographers.
If you have never done this, I really want at least one person to discover this ritual as a result of this podcast. Get Mass Romantic, an album by the New Pornographers.
Their first album.
Put your windows down in your car. Find a sunny, gorgeous day. All those elements must be in place. And take a drive. And you will see that I am right. Okay.
All of my windows or just some of them?
All, preferably
How much exposure to outside
preferably,
do I have
You need
to
a
have?
Lot of air. You
okay.
need a lot
yeah,
of
okay.
air.
You want a lot of air.
All right.
Okay. And finally, General Hospital has been celebrating its 50th anniversary.
That's a little squeal.
Its 50th anniversary. And on Friday, I got a tweet from my pal Joe Reed, who also follows ABC Soaps, who alerted me to something that had happened that day on General Hospital at the Nurses' Ball, which they organized.
Nurses' Ball, shout
out.
For
the 50th anniversary. I almost don't know how to put it into words. It's so remarkably amazing. As some of you know, I was a Frisco Jones, Jack Wagner person as a teenager. I saw him in concert as an alleged singer twice. Twice.
Did you say alleged singer?
He
Jack
sang?
Wagner? All
twice.
I need.
He
that's
too
that's
sang.
A,
okay.
a chart-topping ballad.
So he's back for the 50th anniversary, as is practically everyone else who's ever been on that show.
Oh my God.
Came back for the 50th.
Sonny and Brenda.
And at the Nurses' Ball, he came on. And he performed All I Need.
You are kidding me! Did that happen for reals?
Okay, Barry just redlined the entire show.
Yeah. We really should have used that for the excitement level.
He did. And it is not only that, but it's a slightly like jazzed up version with more drums. It is one of the funniest and most awesome and most like he doesn't look bad for how
no.
old
no.
he.
When did he ever look bad?
He's on a recent episode of The Celebrity Apprentice.
Yeah,
oh, please bury me now.
It's I'm gonna link to the episode on Hulu because seriously, you just see, I can't even. It made me beyond happy because it made me feel 16 years old. And, like, I had terrible taste in music all over again.
Oh, my God. I'm so doing that with the windows down. On the way home from this taping, you can't stop me.
So that's what's making me happy this week. All four things that make me happy this week. Thank you all for your patience. And that brings us to the end of our episode. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow Barry at B Hardiman, H-A-R-D-Y-M-O-N. You can follow Margaret H. Willison at Mrs. Friday Next. That's Mrs. Friday Next, all one word, no periods. You can follow our pal Trey Graham at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow our esteemed producer Jess Gittner doing heroic duty this week at Jess Gittner, G-I-T-N-E-R. You can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band Hello Come In provides our in and out music, which you are listening to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here, especially Margaret.
Yay!
Yay!
And thanks to all of you for listening, and then we will see you back here next week.